You're listening to the Operational Maritime Law Podcast, presented by the NATO Center of Excellence for Operations in Confined and Shallow Waters, headquartered in Kiel, Germany. To learn more, please visit coecsw.org.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Operational Maritime Law Podcast. I'm James Cook, and with me today is Captain Dr. Martin Fink. In a field that is often starkly divided between academics and practitioners, Martin is an absolute master of both. He has been a longtime legal advisor in the Royal Netherlands Navy and is currently serving as research fellow at the Royal Netherlands Defense Academy. He also holds the position of head of legal affairs of the Royal Netherlands Marechaussee, which I apologize to our Dutch listeners for having mispronounced, and is a frequent lecturer on the law of naval operations at the International Institute for Humanitarian Law in San Remo, Italy, which is actually where I first had the pleasure of meeting and learning from Dr. Fink. In addition to having held a number of legal positions in the Netherlands Armed Forces, as well as NATO Joint Forces Command in Naples, Italy, he also holds a real wealth of operational experience. His deployments include Iraq, multiple tours in Afghanistan, the UN mission to South Sudan, as well as Israel and the Palestinian territories. Aside from his operational chops, Captain Fink is also an internationally renowned legal scholar who holds an LLM from the University of Leiden and received his PhD from the University of Amsterdam. He's a prolific author. I honestly have no idea how he writes so much, so well, and so quickly, but we're grateful that he does, because today we're going to talk with him about an article that he published in the November 2022 edition of the International Review of the Red Cross, entitled "The Ever-Existing Crisis of the Law of Naval Warfare." Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, James. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And I got to say, I really enjoyed reading this article when I did. You know how sometimes reading multiple things at the same time, they coincide and make each other make more sense. And I just finished Max Hastings' book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there's this really interesting anecdote he has in there where the U.S. Secretary of Defense, this is right after they establish, this is 1962, and when the U.S. establishes a quarantine around Cuba. And the Secretary of Defense goes to the Chief of the Navy and says, like, how are we going to actually implement this? What's going to happen if the ship tries to cross the quarantine line? How are we going to escalate? And the Chief of Naval Operations at the time just grabs the 1955 copy of the Law of Naval Warfare and says, well, it's all right here. And I think I mentioned this because I think a couple years ago, before I took your class in San Remo, I would have thought, oh, that makes sense. That's probably applicable. But now I'm not so sure if that's the right answer. And so I'll ask you, can you just kind of quickly lay out, when does the Law of Naval Warfare apply and to whom?
That's actually quite interesting, because the laws of naval warfare apply, in fact, only during armed conflict. And as most of the listeners most probably also know, is that the laws of armed conflict apply in two situations, one in a non-international armed conflict and in the other in an international armed conflict. And what is special about the laws of naval warfare is that they actually only apply during a international armed conflict. So actually their application during armed conflict is actually quite limited, I must say.
Yeah, and I think that's something that often gets lost. And another thing that I think is hard for naval practitioners is wrapping their heads around the difference between the law of naval warfare versus the IHL, international humanitarian law, versus law of the sea. Can you kind of just clarify what the difference is between those things?
Surely. The laws of naval warfare are, in first instance, they are a specialized part of IHL, so a specialized part of the laws of war, which also means that, for instance, the general principles of IHL, such as distinction or proportionality, they also apply within the maritime dimension. So you need to look at the laws of naval warfare as a special part of of IHL, of international humanitarian law. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that the laws of naval warfare and the law of the sea are actually two separate legal regimes, but very closely knit together. So the laws of the sea apply during peace crisis times and also during international and armed conflict in general. and deal as a main subject with the rules in the different maritime zones in the ocean. So what kind of jurisdiction states have in their different kinds of maritime zones, and also what the navigational rights are for the international shipping. So that's the law of the sea part of it. Now, as I said, I mean, the laws of naval warfare apply during international armed conflict, but we'll have to take into account also the law of the sea, because that applies at all times. So while operating during armed conflicts, navies should take into account, for instance, where they can and cannot undertake hostilities. So, for instance, you cannot undertake hostilities within the territorial sea or within the internal waters of a neutral state. Or you cannot undertake hostilities while passing an international strait. So the regime for the international strait is you know, then you have to fall back to the laws of the sea. So that is that is in a nutshell, let's say, the relationship between the laws of naval warfare and the law of the sea and IHL.
Well, it makes it sound so clear cut, right? Like you have these laws that are applicable during naval warfare. You have these laws that are applicable during armed conflict, which law of naval warfare is a part of. And then you have law of the sea, which is separate, but also, you know, still applicable, whether we're at peace and at war or in an armed conflict rather. I think that belies what you kind of get at in your article, which is that there has been this existing longstanding crisis regarding the law of naval warfare, an identity crisis of sorts. Can you kind of lay out what your argument is when you say that?
I would say there's a number of issues that contribute to this statement. That as long as I've been in the Navy and dealing with these questions, has always been there. Let me just point out three things on this point. First, for a large part, the naval warfare laws are just simply not codified in treaty law, and therefore it means that they are, you know, largely depending on international customary law. So apart from the question, what is or what isn't customary within this legal regime, and the question whether or not you are actually part of the treaties or not, international law, as you know, is usually less clear, and especially also in the practical details of this law. So that's one bit of crisis, so to say. And fair or not, I would say that when parts of the law are left unused for a long period of time with no practice at all, there's always a bit of a discussion on whether these rules are actually customary or actually still applicable. So that's the first one. Secondly, and maybe also because of the fact that there is no comprehensive treaty law body, there's always this continuous feeling that the law of naval warfare seems to be unclear where it stands on different subjects. For instance, on how to enforce blockades or to transform civilian shipping into warships. Or another example is the rules on contraband and whether they still apply or not. And there's also not a lot of clarity on what states do or do not agree on. Well, and as a third point, I would point out that that this part of the law of IHL of the laws of war seems somewhat obscure, with special rules applicable only to the maritime environment. So just it's a fact that also not many people are really knowledgeable in this part of the law and are not really involved in it in their daily business. So contrary to IHL, in the general sense, the knowledge of this area of the law is simply not widespread. And if there's no knowledge, questions keep popping up on what the law actually is. They just keep coming back. So, you know, for me, those three points would be why we always say that the laws of naval warfare is always in a continuous state of crisis. There's just not a lot there, which is within treaty law, and there is just not a lot of knowledge, really, on the law itself.
I want to get back to some of those points specifically in a second, but can you just, in general terms, in regards to international law, can you clarify what you mean, or the relationship between customary law versus treaty law in this context?
Well, I guess the point of departure then would be that the difficulty is from which starting point you start interpreting the law from a practical perspective. I would say, from a treaty law, obviously you start from the treaty, and then it's actually very clear, and you start arguing on a specific legal question. The practical application of customary law would be a little bit harder, because there's simply no black letter rule that to start from, but there are only governmental positions, and for different subjects, states may probably don't have a state position. It stays rather vague, I would say, from if you only have international customary law that you need to build your argument on. One example, for instance, is the position on sunken warships, to give you a very specific one. There's clearly no treaty on that. And there's the state's position that a sunken warship still stays immune when it is sunken. But that's custom, and or not. We're not really sure what it is. So that's hard from a practical perspective to build your arguments on whether or not it is actually so. So I would say that would be the practical challenge is between the difference of treaty law, interpreting the law from a treaty, and interpreting the law from a customary standpoint. And always, obviously also, because we're talking first of all in the context of international law, but also, the naval operations is almost per definition nowadays a subject in which we also always work together in coalitions. So it depends on the coalition you have, whether or not you can actually have one view on a certain subject, or depending on the coalition, you can have more views on a certain subject. So if you have a treaty law and everybody is part of that treaty, it makes it easier for you to interpret and know what the law is. If you have to argue it from a international customary perspective, well, that's just simply a little bit more difficult if you have different nations that have different views on it.
And that goes to your first point about there being no actual codification for a lot of these elements of what we consider to be the law of naval operations or the law of naval warfare. The other part you mentioned was this limited state practice. And so I think when you read this article that you wrote for IRRC in context with some of the other articles you've written about for the Lieber Institute, like the Articles of War, as it pertains to this ongoing conflict in Ukraine, I think it's kind of building. We're having to confront these issues of this lack of state practice that has existed for so long that you identify as one of these crisis elements. And so I'm just wondering, what are some of the specific, you mentioned Rex as being kind of a specific manifestation of this. But what are some of the other specific issues related to the law of naval warfare that you see kind of bubbling to the surface once again and presenting these kind of challenges that we haven't had to wrestle with for a while?
Well, the law of blockade is the most obvious example at this stage, I would say. Not only from the current conflict that we see now between Russia and Ukraine, but in the past years, we've seen more of these situations, for instance, also off the coast of the Gaza. And arguably, at least that I think that would be a de facto blockade, but also at least a kind of inspection, kind of operation also off the coast of Yemen. So we see in one way or another, we see blockade type of operations. We see this coming back. So one of the things that need thinking, I would say, is how do we interpret the law of blockade in modern conflict as we are now? And I would say, interestingly, if you look at the law of blockade and going back to the lack of treaty law, there's actually only one rule that is codified in treaties. And that is that a blockade has to be effective. And that rule comes from 1865, I believe, after the Crimean War, from 1865. But that's in fact only the only rule that we have codified in the treaty. All the other rules that we think that are rules within the law of blockade, they are custom. Well, there are, I think, You could say there are certain rules that we could regard as custom, but there are also more practical rules on, for instance, where to enforce a blockade that are not so custom as we may think. And there could be different views from different states on how to enforce that. to make it a little bit more, let's say, more practical or more focused is the question. Well, if you impose a blockade, is you basically cut off a piece of water that goes into a harbor or into a coast. So the question would be, where can you actually enforce that blockade? Would it be in that piece of water that you have pointed out as the blockaded waters? Or can you also do it outside of that specific piece of water? For instance, if you already know that there is a certain ship that will most probably be breaching the blockade. So the question would then be, could you also already take action against those shippings, or do you actually need to wait until these vessels are actually within the blockaded area? And it would make a lot of difference in how to enforce it, obviously. But those practical questions, those don't have very clear answers as from different states as to whether what the law actually is.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a whole episode in and of itself on the law or not law of blockade.
Yeah, for sure.
And I hope to do that soon.
Yeah.
But just to kind of lay out the basic facts here of blockade, can you describe what it, according to customary international law, what we kind of believe it to be in the basic tenets of it? So we know it has to be effective. What are kind of some of the other things that constitute a blockade?
For a blockade to be legally established, because I think that's what you're asking, for a blockade to be legally established, it should be formally notified at first. That's the first requirement. The second requirement would be that it should be impartially conducted against all vessels of all states. And then there is a third requirement, and that's the one that I already told you. The blockade should be effective. So those are the basic requirements really to legally establish a blockade. And legally establish a blockade, what does that mean? So what's the difference really between a non-legally established blockade or a legally established blockade? Is the moment that you have actually established it in the right way, you'll get far-reaching authorities to actually enforce that blockade. So, for instance, civilian vessels that will try to breach the blockade can be captured, or if they do not listen, then ultimately there might be a chance that they actually become military objectives, which means that they can be targeted. So there you go. I think that's a really far-reaching authority if you have actually established blockade, because or else you will have freedom of navigation. And you can't really do anything against those civilian shipping. So once you have gone through those three requirements, if you've done it right, then it would mean that you actually get far-reaching authorities to do so, to enforce the blockade.
Interesting. And that's also very helpful too, and not just in the context of the war in Ukraine, but as you pointed out, there are other instances around the world where this is applicable. And so it's necessary for us to kind of find an answer to these questions about when is it legally established, because legally establishing it, as you mentioned, opens up a lot of opportunities to the belligerent that is enforcing it. And so I kind of want to talk about what some of those rights are and what some of those measures are that a belligerent can assume, and kind of what the duties are of neutral states as well when this is imposed. I'm getting at things like contraband lists and being able to search vessels, as you mentioned, where you can establish that, if it has to be in the immediate vicinity of the area of operations, or if they have to establish some kind of maritime zone, or whether or not you can just do it at any inbound journey.
Yeah, I think first of all, we need to take one step back, because you're asking me, for instance, about contraband. Now, within the law of naval warfare, you can point out actually three different methods of warfare, so to say. And they're all three different methods. So one is the contraband law, one is the law of blockade, and the third one is let's say the law of maritime operational zones. And they all focus on different things. And they also have their own legal regime to it. So the first thing that we shouldn't do is to mix up contraband law with blockade law, because they're two different things. So contraband law basically focuses on contraband goods and the capture of vessels somewhere on the high sea. So if there's suspicion that they actually help the enemy, we can take them on the high seas. But it's focused on goods and it's focused on vessels. Blockade and blockade law focuses on the coast, or focuses on the harbors or whatever is being closed off, which means that they're not focusing on the goods or they're not focusing on the vessels. And a maritime operational zone basically focuses on a certain maritime area, which is closed off up to a certain level. It doesn't really matter whether or not, if we're going back to the blockade law now, so it doesn't really matter whether they actually have contraband on board or not, because the focus of a blockade and the law of blockade is that you get the authority to just stop every vessel that goes in or out, whoever it is, whatever it is. And it doesn't really matter what they have on board. It doesn't really matter what kind of flag they have or etc. It is just focused on stopping all traffic that is going in or that is going out.
Okay, so that's kind of what's meant by being effective. It's not that they're stopping the contraband from coming in, it's that they're stopping everything from coming in or coming out.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I just wanted to add is that effectiveness, you know, effectiveness is a question of fact. So when is it actually the case that it's something is actually effective or not? How do you do this? So what is the practical consequences of being effective?
So if we are imposing a blockade, right? A given state's imposing a blockade, it cannot be effective if you let vessels breach the blockade. So can you talk about what some of the measures are that are taken against vessels that breach a blockade? Let's say it's a neutral state or a state that's not, you know, a state that's not party to the armed conflict. If they fail to recognize the blockade, what kind of options are open up to the state that's enforcing it?
In general, there would be two authorities or two things that you can actually do. So the moment that you have identified this vessel that is breaching a blockade, obviously you warn it first that saying, you know, you're breaching a blockade, you know, go back or stop or sail somewhere else. But the moment that you have identified this vessel, you're entitled to capture it or to seize it, which means you can actually, you know, go on board the vessel and basically take over the control of the vessel. And then take it somewhere else. That would be the benign version of seizing the vessel. So that's action one. Now you could also have the possibility that the breaching vessel or the vessel that is trying to breach the blockade does it on purpose and does not want to be captured. Then, well, there's clearly also still the possibility of trying to capture it in one way or another. But if it continues to do so, and if it continues not to listen, then we'll come up to the question of whether or not the vessel actually becomes a military objective, or at least loses its protection against attack. So that would be the case if a civilian vessel would be running a blockade on purpose, does not comply with any orders, and is trying to run it, basically. Of course, you know, before we start attacking a vessel, there's clearly also the standard targeting rules that apply. But a vessel that is running a blockade on purpose and doesn't listen would open up to be attacked.
So far, we've spoken in kind of generalities about how blockade might apply in theory, specifically about Ukraine and Russia. We have this Green Deal. Obviously, vessels are not being stopped from coming in or out on a complete basis, which kind of indicates that it is not in a blockade. What do you think is preventing Russia from instituting a blockade? Because it seems like, to me, that they would benefit greatly from establishing one. Maybe not. What are your thoughts?
Well, I actually agree with you. From a legal or international law perspective, they would greatly benefit. Why? Because if they actually would actually pose a blockade and would also go through the three legal requirements, then you'll as we spoke about, you gain more authorities to actually do stuff. You know, it would only be a positive thing from a state to actually blockade in a legal sense. One challenging part of this war specifically is that you have this deliberate Russian narrative in which they deliberately do not say that they are in the international armed conflict, but they are, you know, it's a special military operation, etc., etc. So they deliberately do not use the standard wording and the standard interpretation of international law, but they deliberately do something else. And you also see this back within the different court cases that we have. For instance, a couple of years ago with the capture of those three small warships of Ukraine that were trying to pass the Strait of Kerch. Same question there, same issue there. So although from a legal standpoint, it would be interesting to say, yes, I have established a blockade so that I get a lot of authority. But from the Russian political narrative, it doesn't fit.
So if by claiming that they're imposing a blockade, they de facto admit to being engaged in an international armed conflict.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so that is what it seems that they would like to get away from giving them those labels. So, which makes it harder for us, for the rest, to understand what is going on or not. We're not really sure. You know, I've written an article also on the, on this particular question. You know, and apart from the one of the biggest issue clearly to me is that there at this stage are no facts, which makes it hard to tell you what the law then would be or whether or not they actually have done something. But also the narrative just blurs the whole situation. So, yeah, we don't really know what is going on. It's a little bit frustrating, but, the narrative is one thing I would say.
No, that makes a lot of sense too, because whenever I hear people talk about this specific issue, it's usually in the context of escalation. So it's, oh, well, they're not going to do it because it's escalatory. But I think this, the legal argument of saying, well, we might get legal benefits from imposing a blockade, but it's going to put additional impositions in terms of IHL on a broader scale if we admit to engaging in an armed conflict. I think that makes a lot of sense. At what point does state practice evolve into something where there's no such thing as a blockade? It's just a kind of an inspection regime, and it's as long as it's conducted with kind of good faith on behalf of allowing humanitarian aid and so forth, enter and exit. And since we haven't really seen any legal recourse against states that have imposed non-blockades, at what point does this kind of become just the normal state practice and the law of naval warfare doesn't pertain necessarily?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, really, on how do you interpret international law, and how does, you know, international law develop and form? So that's, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. But maybe going to because I think that's in the context of your question also interesting is going to the Gaza blockade, for instance. So the Gaza blockade was an actual blockade, and it's also argued from Israel that it is an actual blockade for different reasons. And you know, they've done all the things, implemented all the requirements, and everything, which meant, let's say, from a legal perspective, on establishing a blockade, they've ticked all the boxes. The trouble here is the question of what kind of character the Gaza blockade has. Is it a non-international armed conflict, or is it an international armed conflict? So if we, as I said in the beginning of this episode, is that the laws of naval warfare apply only in an international armed conflict. Now, the Gaza conflict is difficult. There's different kind of arguments, whether it's a NIAC or whether it's an IAC. Now, coming back to your question, it's a fact that this blockade is enforced off the coast of the Gaza. Is this already the first step into a development of the law of blockade also being possible, or also applies in a non-international armed conflict or not? Do we now, after this instance and the blockade has been enforced for already quite some years, is this now something of a development in which we start to accept that the law of blockade is also applicable, or could also be applicable, within a non-international armed conflict? I don't know. But as you said, there is not a lot of states that are particularly against it. There's not a lot of states that say out loud that this is actually not possible. Now, clearly also because of the fact that the background of the Gaza conflict is very complex, in which it's hard to tell whether it's a NIAC or an IAC. But this could be one of those things and that's also what we discuss clearly also within our community. Is whether this is the first step of accepting that the law of blockade should also, in one way or another, be applicable in a non-international armed conflict, and thus develops into something new.
So we've talked a bit about some of the issues with the law as it currently stands. I want to get to this idea of what you refer to as future-proofing the law. What do you mean by that, and kind of how do we do it?
Well, what I meant by that is that in one way or another, we keep the laws of naval warfare relevant. As we already discussed, indeed, also is that you know, we have these two discussions of whether or not some parts of the laws of naval warfare are still applicable or not. That fits the discussion of whether or not the laws of naval warfare are actually future proof. So to me, the most important thing is just, you know, basically to keep abreast of the issues that we see today in the naval dimension. And at least from a scholarly perspective, to start and keep discussing them. You know, as we talked about the not enough knowledge or not enough knowledgeable persons or experts within the field, to me also the laws of naval warfare have to come out of that shadow. We are talking about the IHL a lot. I mean, it's one of the most important and one of the most talked about legal regimes, and the laws of naval warfare is part of it. But we do not seem to have a lot of discussion within that part of the law. So we need to get it out there and get it into the light and ensure that more people get enthusiastic on it, which means that you can have more views, more thoughts on it. So that's another thing. And as a third thing, I would say what we also need to do to future-proof it is to follow those technological developments that we have now and nowadays at sea, and find timely answers for those challenges that emerge with these developments. Unmanned maritime vehicles, modern mines, maritime drones, all these subjects. They're new technological developments that need legal discussion, also need legal answers. So if you want to keep the laws of naval warfare relevant, then you need to dive into these answers and try to get answers to how to deal with those new technological developments. So if you do that, then to me, you're also future-proofing the laws of naval warfare.
Well, that gets into a kind of a deeper international law issue that I wanted to talk to you about, because you address it in your article here when you identify kind of one of the reasons that naval law hasn't been subjected to additional treaty making in recent years, despite all the holes that we've had pop up, is that the ambiguity of it all kind of helps states who are looking to stake out a their own political strategic position where international law might otherwise, you know, be hostile to that stance. So I kind of want to just not to be a pessimist, but how do you see the role or the relevance of naval law when so much of it is left intentionally ambiguous as a result of states wanting to make out of it whatever they is most politically expedient?
Well, maybe two things on this. First of all, we talked about the point that the laws of naval warfare are part of international humanitarian law. And international humanitarian law comes with a lot of obligations and that you need to implement, like sanctioning distinction, proportionality, et cetera, and it is about lives. The laws of naval warfare, the heart of the laws of naval warfare, is not really about life and death, but it's about economic warfare. It's about money and enforcing the other state to stop having the economic means to go on with their war making. So as a starter, I would say that's a different view on how to look at this type of law. So that's one thing.
I see. So you're saying just because law of blockade hasn't materialized into some sort of very effective regime, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to say. Don't discount all the life protecting features of naval law for the sake of saying, well, and blockade hasn't been working lately, let's just give up on it.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one thing. And the other thing is which I also argue in my article, and as I said also in the beginning, part of the question why there is this continuous crisis is not because there is no law, but it's because there is not a lot of experts or not a lot of knowledge among us. So it doesn't mean that there is no law at all. And apart from that, I mean, even if it's very open to much interpretation as it stands now, I mean, we still need to abide to some general rules and the rules that exist at the moment. I mean, at this moment, it provides us with the necessary guidelines on how to conduct naval warfare, although not into much depth and much detail, but at least gives us a certain level of direction in what we need to do.
So what are some of those points within the law of naval warfare that are still readily agreed upon? Can you kind of characterize the current state of the law of naval war? What are some of the big things that this is still helping lawyers and states make decisions that protect people in time of warfare?
I would say that one of the rules within the laws of naval warfare that has absolutely no argument against it or something like that is the right of visit. You're allowed to visit other civilian shipping when you think they are carrying contraband or suspicious of carrying contraband. Now, that rule is just simply not subject to any argument. That's a standard issue that is accepted readily.
So regarding the other issues that are not so cut and dry, how do we even start addressing this continuous crisis, as you say, in the state of the law currently?
It's hard. I've been thinking about this for a long time, how to get that spinning wheel moving, so to say. But I don't know. There's I think in general there may perhaps be three ways to go forward. One is going back to the London Declaration of 1909, because that treaty actually tried to make a comprehensive treaty on price law, on economic warfare law. So one of the ways to go forward is going back to that London Declaration and see what is or what is now accepted as international law. Another way is not to take a comprehensive and an overarching view, because it's obviously that is in practice very difficult to start with, but to start very, very small. The things that we encounter now at the moment, the things that we encounter now within the context of, let's say, Ukraine-Russia war or the Gaza Strip conflict, etc. So look at those particular areas of the laws of naval warfare and try to find those lessons that might be there within those conflicts. And see how you can build on what is there at the moment, and see how you can build on from there on. So start small. And the third option is start looking at the so-called San Remo manual, because the manual, and also in combination clearly also with different state manuals. But the manual, as you know, the San Remo manual has been accepted, widely accepted as one of the sources or soft sources of the laws of naval warfare. It's really the go-to guide when you don't know what the laws of naval warfare are. And start reviewing it and try to see whether or not the guidelines that are in the San Remo manual are also accepted as international law by states. I would say those would be three ways to go forward. Well, again, I mean, the first option may not be realistic, because that's the overall approach, and it needs some state incentive to actually do that. And honestly, I don't think the state incentive at this stage is there. The second, starting from very small, that might very well be possible. And also the third. Yeah, well, as you might know, we're looking at the San Remo manual at the moment and to see how we can update it. But it is I think it's a hard and complex process. So the best option really, and that's also how international law usually develops, is look at practice. So start small, look at the things that we have at the moment, grab them and discuss them and see what we, at least from our scholarly perspective, see what we can get out of it.
Yeah, I think that's a very helpful kind of way to bracket what it is we can do moving forward, from the most helpful, least likely, to the more likely tangible, actionable items that we can start undertaking right now. And to that end, and I kind of want to blend this with your comment about the San Remo manual, just as a kind of practical measure, I've been curious about this. In what way does, if at all, do military manuals influence deliberations within this, the people who kind of discuss what gets into the San Remo and what doesn't? Do military manuals play a role in kind of establishing state practice?
I think it does. I think it does a lot. Well, first of all, because of the fact that clearly, again, there's no treaty law. There's no law to go back to in which that states have accepted, and state manuals are the expression of, or should be the expression of, the position of states. So that's where we get our sources from. So no, absolutely. I mean, states manuals are a wealthy source and a very important source to see what the position of the law would be. Now, the challenge, I would say, for the laws of naval warfare is how many state manuals exist within the world that actually have stuff on the laws of naval warfare. I don't know. We have 191 states or something like that. But I'm not sure that all these states also have state manuals that also address the laws of naval warfare. I would guess that's not the case. That doesn't have to be, because, if you're not a great sea power, then it doesn't make real sense to do so. But I think one of the challenges with relevant states, and one of the challenges with state manuals, in relation to the laws of naval warfare, is that if you read them, they are very general. So also there, we don't see any details, which is, for scholars, that's a shame, because there's nothing to play with. So yes, they matter. But if you then go into those state manuals, there's only a few states, obviously the most obvious one is the United States, but there's only a few states that really go into detail in this particular part of the law.
I want to jump into kind of your last point about this crisis in the law of naval war, and that is this lack of knowledge, lack of expertise specific to this unique body of law. So accepting the fact that there is kind of a very few people who deal with this exclusively or intimately, even amongst those experts, there's this ongoing debate about whether the fundamental principles of naval law are even valid today, now that belligerent rights don't necessarily exist in a post-UN charter world. So kind of what do you make of this argument, and what does it kind of portend for naval law in particular?
It is an interesting argument indeed. It basically goes to the issue of civilian property at sea. So the traditional law says that civilian property at sea is still seizable if you are in international armed conflict. And that's already a difference from the land dimension, because the civilian property is as a point of departure. You cannot take it unless there is some sort of a necessity or something like that. The difference at sea is that civilian property is actually seizable. So, if you take one step deeper, so the rule would be that if you have a civilian vessel that is flying the flag of the enemy, you can seize it, capture it, and take it. It doesn't have to be part of hostilities or something like that, but just because of the fact that they fly the flag of your enemy, you can take it. Now, that is a fundamental rule of the laws of naval warfare, let's say the traditional law of naval warfare. And what we see now is that, well, those particular points, so contraband law in this case, well, it's being discussed whether or not this fundamental rule should actually exist nowadays. Especially within a world where you are, the maritime transport world is totally internationalized. We also see a flask of convenience, etc. So there's no direct link between, not always a direct link between the flag and the state. This really questions the issue of whether this fundamental rule of civilian property at sea, if it's still seizable, whether or not it should exist at the moment. So you would then you have the traditional law of naval warfare experts that say, yes, of course, this it's a long-standing rule. And then you have the other experts, other scholars that would say, now, wait a minute, there's the world has changed, international law has changed, the views have changed, and maybe we should get rid of this old rule. Because it's old, it doesn't mean that it has to exist in this modern day and age. So that's one of those interesting, I must say, it is an interesting discussion indeed. What it goes to, I don't know. Where we end up, this is also one of those subjects that we don't have practice on. So on the one hand, we have the classical views that civilian property at sea should still be captured or is capturable. And then we have the new view, but we don't have practice. So we don't really know whether or not this, states would actually go for it or not.
I've had a lot of discussions with Terry Gill about one of your fellow countrymen, about just the practical impediments to doing that kind of a thing. Regardless of whether or not we decide that the law is applicable, implementing it effectively is a different story, especially when you don't have that expertise or that experience readily accessible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And allow me to comment on this because this is very interesting. I totally agree with Professor Gill that the practicalities nowadays, it's just simply undoable to actually start visiting and searching a whole container vessel at sea. So most probably it would just almost immediately result into diverting a ship into a harbor to do the inspection, and then you'll have a ship that will be there for weeks and etc. So that's there are a lot of practicalities that would ultimately most probably move a state into the conclusion that they're not going to use it because it's just too difficult to execute. That's one thing. The other thing is price courts. What is interesting to note here is that we talked about the Gaza block. Okay. Now, the Israelis actually have set up new prize courts. So they have captured, I'm not sure how many ships, so somewhere between 5 or 6 or 7, at least a few. And part of the laws of naval warfare is also to have those prize courts. So what they actually have set up a new prize court process in which they actually put those captures before those seizures before a prize court. Apart from the Israeli experience, it's almost gone. If I look at the Dutch legislation, for instance, we actually pulled out the competence of the High Court. It used to be the High Court that actually could do price court cases. somewhere in 2000 to 2001, we actually pulled out the competence of the High Court to actually do prize court cases. So legislation on prize courts doesn't exist anymore in the Netherlands. It's relatively easy to put it back again, but it says something that the Ministry of Justice just pulled it out of the legislation because they thought, just like piracy, it doesn't exist anymore.
Right, like it's not a current competency of that court to be able to adjudicate those cases because they haven't had any experience of it. So why have it?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's really fascinating. So speaking of competencies, you've had a really wide-ranging career. Of course, you're well known for your academic contributions, but you had a lot of experiences in the operational world as a naval officer. And so I'm curious, kind of, can you maybe reflect back on some of those experiences you had as a junior officer and maybe help provide some advice to kind of get smart on those topics that are going to be relevant in an operational environment, particularly a maritime environment?
Well, my advice would be very simple. Get out there as much as possible as you can on operations. Those are the most important things. But, you know, take any exercise, whatever, get out there and see what's going on. I mean, this is operational law. It's not law that is in the library so that you can learn from the books, etc. The challenges lay out there on the for us this SO at sea. That's where you can actually see what the real issues are and what our fellow colleagues are grappling with. So from those grappling issues, that's where you, to me, that's where you also make a difference as a lawyer, that you can, if you understand those and if you can help your fellow colleagues in the naval domain to overcome those challenges. I mean, that's for me the driving force of doing international law and within the naval domain. But, again, to go short, just go out there as much as possible, even if you are, appointed at an administrative job or a criminal law job. There's bound to be situations that you can just, you can ask your boss to say, yeah, you know what, there's an exercise for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Let me go on there and experience it. So get as much as experience as possible, either from exercises or from the operations.
Yeah, and I know helping and training other legal officers is a passion of yours. You're in San Remo right now teaching officers from around the world on the law of armed conflict. You teach at the Netherlands Defense Academy. You're going to be participating in a lot of conferences in the near future geared towards helping people come to terms with these naval specific legal considerations that they need to be able to advise commanders on and participate in the decision making process. I know you contribute a lot of that, not just through teaching, but also through writing. And so I'm curious, what's kind of next on the plate for you? Is there anything that you've got in the works currently that you've been thinking a lot about, that you're writing about?
I am. I'm doing a small study on the blockade of the Aceh during the Dutch colonial period. So the Aceh is a piece of area which lies on the northern tip of the island of Sumatra, which used to be the Dutch Indonesia. So the colonies. Well, the Dutch wanted to subdue this part of the island in 1873. And they thought that the islanders would lie over very quickly. No, they were completely wrong. And, it turned out to be a very long war of 20 years fighting the islanders. And, during that period, also the Dutch laid a number of different blockades, off the coast of that island. And there's not a lot, first of all, there's not a lot of literature on that. And also it's one of the few blockades that the Netherlands has established by its own as a real war blockade. I just thought, I need to know more about this. This is actually quite interesting from a Dutch perspective. So a legal history study I'm doing at the moment. And maybe there are some lessons learned from that legal history that we have.
That's really fascinating. I love talking to you. You've always got something cool in the works, and I always learn a lot from our conversations. I really appreciate your time and for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
The COE CSW is a leading NATO think and do tank focused on enhancing military capabilities to contend with the security challenges posed in the world's confined and shallow waters. As a reminder, the views expressed in this podcast are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the positions of NATO, the COE CSW, or any of the institutions to which the participants belong.